Welcome to Native America Calling from Studio 49 in Albuquerque. I'm Tara Gatewood. The descendants of Attu Island want to return to their ancestral homeland. The 44 people who called Attu home were taken prisoner after the Japanese invaded the island during World War II. No one has inhabited it since. On the show today, we'll talk with some of the descendants and a reporter following their journey. We'll also get a glimpse of this remote island's history. Join us for this discussion right after National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Indigenous people are converging with environmental groups in San Francisco this week at a gathering where leaders are discussing climate policy. Christina Onnested reports.
Indigenous leaders and climate justice activists are calling on governors around the world who are gathering at the Global Climate Action Summit to transition from fossil fuel developments to renewables. They're also demanding policymakers abandon cap-and-trade policies. They say allow polluters to damage one environment in exchange for another. Indigenous activists say the air is not a commodity to be brokered. Here's an organizer of the action. While many governments have adopted cap-and-trade policies, critics say they just shield corporate polluters instead of providing real environmental protections against climate change. Christina Onnested, National Native News, California.
The National Congress of American Indians objects to the Interior Department's decision that it cannot hold land into trust for the Mashpee Wampanoag tribe in Massachusetts. Tribes across the country and Native organizations closely waited for the outcome, concerned about impacts on tribal land policy. NCAI says the decision restricts sovereignty and is a failure of trust responsibility. On Friday, the Interior Department reversed a 2015 land into trust approval for the tribe, citing it does not qualify due to a lack of federal jurisdiction in the 1930s. Opponents of the tribe's plan to build a casino challenged the trust land. The Eastern Band of Cherokee Indians in North Carolina is preparing for Hurricane Florence. On Monday, President Trump approved an emergency declaration for states and tribes, including the Eastern Band and the Catawba Indian Nation in South Carolina. The National Weather Service alerts the hurricane is likely to hit southeast coast later this week. Attorneys for the Rosebud Sioux Tribe in the Fort Belknap Indian community challenging the Trump administration's permit for the Keystone XL pipeline say the State Department violated laws and regulations. Victoria Wicks has more.
The South Dakota and Montana tribes are suing Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and now retired Undersecretary for Political Affairs Thomas Shannon Jr. The tribes say the Trump administration overturned the Obama administration's denial of the pipeline without establishing a new record of facts supporting the opposite conclusion. Natalie Landreth is an attorney with the Native American Rights Fund. She says this lawsuit overlaps two others filed in Montana against Keystone XL when it comes to administrative procedures, but she says this suit specifically addresses the land and treaty rights that tribes have tried to bring to the attention of the State Department.
The decision about where the pipeline would go or how it would be constructed was made first, and then later, some lip service paid to the tribes, but no real consultation with the tribes ever occurred.
The complaint points out that the pipeline will cross two sources of water for the Miniwichoni Rural Water System that serves the Rosebud Reservation. The suit also alleges that the State Department has not analyzed the impact of inadequate leak detection practices, the potential hazards to tribal members from oil spills, and the effects on the environment and historical sites and artifacts. The proposed KXL pipeline does not cross current reservation land, but comes close to Rosebud and runs through a Montana county adjacent to the Fort Belknap Reservation, as well as crossing ancestral lands in both states. The State Department will now have 60 days to file a response. I'm Victoria Wicks in Rapid City, South Dakota.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation. Funding is by Odawi Law Group, provider of Indian Law Solutions, and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from the Public Radio Satellite System.
For Native Americans affected by domestic violence, the Strong Hearts Native Helpline offers peer-to-peer support and resources. It's safe, confidential, and toll-free at 844-7-NATIVE. Program support by the National Indigenous Women's Resource Center.
Supported by Volunteers of America, a premier substance use treatment provider offering a White Bison certified Wellbriety program within their residential Native American treatment services. Applications and more at voanr.org.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
This is Native America Calling. I'm Tara Gatewood. This year marks 75 years since U.S. troops declared victory over Japanese forces in the Battle of Attu Island in Alaska. But the year before that is also significant for the Aleut residents of Attu and their descendants. That was when Japanese soldiers invaded Attu and took more than 40 residents captive. Those residents never returned to the island. Many of them died of disease and starvation in Japanese camps before the war's end. Now, there's talk of periodic trips for descendants to the island, which is far west as you can go in the Aleutian chain. The history of the island is one of infrequent direct contact with the outside world. It also had experienced earlier conflict with Russian fur traders in the 1700s. Today on the show, we'll hear from descendants from the island's residents, and we'll also talk to a reporter about the latest developments. You can be a part of the discussion, too. Just call 1-800-996-2848, and we'll add your voice to the show. To start us off today, we are going to say hello to Zoe Sobel, who is a reporter with KUCB, where she joins us now in Alaska, in Unalaska. It's our pleasure to bring her into the hour. Zoe, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And Zoe, we're going to use you as kind of setting the scene and telling us more about the history. And what I've learned so far, it is truly rich. And being able to open up this kind of discussion with some of the descendants coming up here in a moment is really important. And so, Zoe, tell us a little bit about Attu Island and how we got to where we are today of even descendants wanting to make that journey home.
That's a great question. So I think you started with a really good summary of thousands of years of history, but what's happened in recent years is last summer a group of 11 descendants got to go back to the island, and that's something that people had been interested in for a while, but because the island is so remote and so hard to get to, had kind of been taken off the table as something that was too hard to organize. But the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service came back in and said that they wanted to do a trip and were able to reach out to all the descendants and find people who were interested in going back that represented many different branches of families who had lived there and different generations, and figure out ways to get them to Alaska if they were not already living here, and then get them out to the Aleutians so we could leave on a week-long boat trip to get to the island and back. And so now I think since that trip, I think there's some more bonds that have been formed through descendants who don't always get to see each other or maybe have never met. And now they're working together to try and see if next future generations or other people who weren't able to go on the trip or even themselves can get to go back and see this island, which is rightfully theirs in a lot of ways. That's where their family's from, and they were taken away.
And so, Zoe, for you, what prompted you to cover this or find more about this story?
So as a new reporter, I think we always have to do a lot of work in learning about our region, and my region is 1,000 miles long, and to think that there are people living so far away on the end in Attu, at the end of the chain, very close to Russia and Japan, in a place that is much more remote than I live, was really surprising, and I wanted to learn more. And once I heard about the atrocities that happened to the Attuans, I think I was just shocked that that had happened, and it had happened so recently, and people didn't know about it. And so I wanted to be able to help share that story.
And how long have you been covering this?
Over a year, talking about Attu.
And if folks want to see some of your stories or see the inside view that you've given to the world, where do they find it?
If you Google KUCB, my radio station call letters, and the word Attu, it should populate a lot of stuff. Or you can go on our KUCB website and find it all there.
All right. Thank you for that. On the line with us today is KUCB reporter Zoe Sobel. She is telling us a little bit about the story she has covered. In a moment, we'll meet some of the descendants. But have you ever heard of this story? Is this something that you've always wanted to learn more about? You can share your thoughts today as we continue to unfold more of the story at 1-800-996-2848. We also talked with Dr. Rachel Mason about her work to learn about Attu Island residents, and she is a senior cultural anthropologist for the National Park Service Alaska Region. She is also the program manager for the Aleutian World War II National Historic Area, which includes Attu. And she says Attu residents had little direct contact with the outside world before the war.
They were very isolated. They lived on fox trapping and money made by selling baskets. And the grass from Attu was known as the best grass for basket weaving. And the residents there, the women were renowned for their basket weaving. I guess what it was known for is the most remote of all the Aleutian villages. And their Coast Guard cutter would come out once a year to and provide medical services. And a priest might arrive once a year or even fewer times. And so the church was really central to the lives of the people there. But it was services were led by a lay reader. And that was Mike Hodakoff, the chief, who was the lay reader before the war. There have been settlements there for maybe 4,000 years from pre-Russian times. So I was working on the Lost Villages Project and trying to organize a boat trip to Attu, but that just didn't happen. We couldn't find a boat that would go out that far or even a plane or anything that would. And so in 2012, instead of a trip to Attu, I organized a reunion, an Attu reunion in Anchorage, and that actually was better than a boat in some ways because some of the more elderly people were able to attend, and more people were able to attend, and so it was really moving to see the people who had grown up outside of Alaska and really had no knowledge of their parents or their grandparents' experience in Japan, and having them come and meet other Aleuts and meet other descendants of Attu, it was incredibly significant for them.
That's Rachel Mason from the National Park Service. She was invited to go to Attu, as you heard, with the 11 descendants for the 75-year commemoration of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife vessel. She was on that vessel. And hearing some of that, Zoe, can you tell us about what it means when some of these descendants get together, some of the words that they've shared with you about how important rebonding is?
I felt like on the boat the whole time, like I was crashing a big family reunion, and it was great. I think different people are able to talk to different parts of their experience and knowledge of their history and the history of their ancestors, and some of the guests you have that we're going to hear from later fit those different categories. You have someone who grew up in Washington State, really outside of it, outside of the culture, somebody who grew up in Atka, which is where a lot of the Atuans were taken and allowed to resettle after the war. And so you kind of have a group of people coming together and sharing things that are meaningful to them. And so it's really wonderful and experiencing that together.
Well, you know what? Let's meet some of them now. You can join us too. 1-800-996-2848 is the number. Maybe your family has connections to Attu Island, if you'd like to share. Maybe you were one of those folks at some of these reunions. What was it like to be with people that maybe you didn't think you'd ever meet? 1-800-996-2848 is the number. And for our tribal nations outside of the Alaska area, does any of this sound familiar? Did similar things happen? You can share your thoughts. How are you relating to what you're hearing about Attu Island? 1-800-996-2848 is the number. Right now, we are going to say hello to Helena Schmitz, a descendant from Attu Island, and she is Attuan, and she joins us today from Anchorage, Alaska. Helena, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thank you. I'd like to quickly introduce myself. I am the daughter of Mary and Ralph Pagano. I am the granddaughter of Angeline Hudakoff, and I am the great-granddaughter of Anisha and Michael Hudakoff, who was the last chief of Attu.
And we are going to learn more about your story, Helena, and just even knowing that we have the honor and privilege to talk to descendants. Sometimes these stories are missed by the rest of the world, and time goes on, and people who have that direct connection are either hard to find or didn't have that ability to speak with their elders and learn about all of this. And so, Helena, I really appreciate you being here with us. We're going to meet your cousin, too, right after the break. But when we think about these kind of histories that rest in our family, and then we get that opportunity to learn more about it, I'm really curious, what happens to our families or that sense of identity, especially for folks who were able to go back to this island, stand on that ground and see the horizon line the way their ancestors did. What do you think about all that? 1-800-996-2848 is the number. And as we hear more about Helena's story and her relatives, if there is a moment where you'd just like to share some thoughts about hearing about this reconnection, you can join us. 1-800-996-2848 is the number. We look forward to adding your voice. Preserving language and changing false perceptions are two of the ambitious goals that some new native coloring book artists are tackling. At the same time, adult coloring books are a creative outlet and a stress reliever for readers. We'll hear from native coloring book artists about their craft and what they hope to achieve. All this on the next Native America Calling.
Smoking gave me COPD, which makes it harder and harder for me to breathe. I have a tip for you. If your doctor gives you 5 years to live, spend it talking with your grandchildren. Explain to them that your grandpa's not going to be around anymore to share his wisdom and his love. I haven't figured out how to do that yet. I'm running out of time.
COPD makes it harder and harder to breathe and can cause death. You can quit. For free help, call 1-800-QUIT-NOW. A message from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
Thank you.
I'm Tara Gatewood, and today we are joined by Helena Schmitz, a descendant of the Attu Island residents, and she is here with us today on Native America Calling. I also want to welcome in her cousin, who is joining us from Vancouver, Washington, Teresa Deal, and she is also a descendant of Attu Island, and she is Inunga. Thank you for joining us as well, Teresa.
Having me. And I'm the daughter of Marina Hodakoff, who's the daughter of Fred Hodakoff, who's the brother of Mike Hodakoff. That's how Helena and I are related.
All right. Thank you for that. And you know what? I want to go straight to how it felt returning to this island, knowing some of this history, knowing who your descendants were and what they faced. Tell me more, Helena.
They weren't given any food. They had about 2 tablespoons of rice per day. They were in the clay mine from 12 to 14 hours. Half of them died of starvation. They were medically experimented on, and amongst other things. There were a lot of war crimes done on our people. We were the only indigenous group that were held in World War II as prisoners of war. And so that's what it means. After 3 years of being there and being saved by the U.S. Army, and returning to San Francisco, and on November 3rd, 1945, was when Attuan's freedom was taken away from my family, and now we are trying to gain our freedom back.
And Helena, when you think of your descendants and or your relatives and what they were facing, and knowing they didn't know what was coming next or what their future would be, what do you think of when you know what they faced?
Can you repeat that question, please?
Sure. Just thinking of what your relatives faced and knowing everything that you just shared, how does it make you feel? Is it something that, you were curious in learning more about? Or is this something that you feel that the world didn't know about and you wanted to create awareness about this?
Yeah, I feel very overwhelmed by it. Pain goes through generation to generation in a lot of Native American cultures, and this is our story and how it goes from generation to generation. And I'm sorry, that's how I...
Sure, it's very, very heavy. And Teresa, any thoughts about this history and what it means to teach others about it? All right, looks like we might have issues with connections. Helena, there is definitely celebration moving forward and knowing that there are people who do want to return and have that connection with this place. Is there anything you want to share? Oh, okay, we lost Helena, but we have Teresa. Okay, Teresa, just share your thoughts. What are you thinking today?
I think it would be going to Attu. I was on that ship that went to Attu with Zoe and Crystal, and just being there was such a magical experience. And I left work for a whole week, and I told them, I said, I have to go. This is an inconvenient time at work, but this is a once-in-a-lifetime trip. And looking back, I think it shouldn't be that way. It shouldn't be a once-in-a-lifetime trip. We should be able to have access, easier access to it.
All right. Well, you know what? There's somebody who is also relating to all this. We got a caller on the line. We're going to say hello to Heidi, who is in Wasilla, Alaska, tuned in on KNBA. Heidi, thank you for giving us a ring. Go ahead, share your thoughts.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. It's Vidi. It's like Heidi, but with a V.
Oh, sorry about that. Vidi, go ahead.
Hi. I was a part of it's called the Rural Human Services College course. And in the course, we were learning about intergenerational trauma. And we saw this video, and it was the first time, and it was all Alaska Natives in the class, and it was the first time we heard about Attu. And so we watched this documentary and everything, and then they brought in this elder, and I'll never forget her because I made such a connection with her. Her name was Alice Petrovelli. And they brought her in, and she was a part of the evacuation, and she was from Atka. She was from Atka. And so she told us her story about the evacuation and how the water, when they put them on these ships, these military ships, and how the water was just coming up over their heads, and it took them so long to get to the southeast. And she was saying when in Etka, she's like, basically there's no trees, it's all flat, and they know how to survive on that land. But when they got to southeast, there were these trees bigger than they've ever seen in their whole life, and the woods were dark, and so they didn't know what animals were in there to hunt. They didn't know what was in there. They didn't know what plants they could eat. They didn't know what berries they could gather that looked different to them. And she said they put them up in this big, huge cannery, but it had nothing in it. It was pretty much bare bones, and they gave them some blankets and a little bit of food that they had to ration, and there were whole families, and she said that they had to find like their little space in that cannery that they could just call their own to keep their families together and keep them warm. And some of the parents had to give up their blanket, and it was, you know, it was cold at night. You know, if you imagine sleeping right outside now in Alaska, it's, you know, getting close to the 40s at night, and with no blanket on in the elements. And her story was just, and our class was on intergenerational trauma, and you just really, it felt like almost firsthand feeling what that felt like to know that there's still survivors alive out there. And when she told me that she was from Atka, I was like, oh my gosh, my sister-in-law, her mother's from Atka. And I never heard anything about this because they're the two women, they're both so positive, and they told their stories, but it was like a story of survival, that we made this and we're stronger. And they're just such powerful, positive people to have come through this. And so I went and I talked to my sister-in-law's mother, and she said that when it happened, when the evacuation happened, her and her whole family, they were out hunting and gathering, and they were gone for a whole week. They didn't even know that it happened. And so they came back home, and everyone was gone, and the military moved in. And she said there was houses on fire. They were ransacking the houses. And when the military, the soldiers discovered them, they put them on the next ship. And she said she was a young girl at the time. I can't remember how old she said she was. And she said it was the same thing. And she said when they got to the island, they took them to a different place than where the rest of the people from Atka went to. And so they had to make connections and learn about the land. And she said the same thing, that the woods were so dark. They're not used to all the trees. They didn't know what kind of animals were in the trees. They didn't know if their water was good to drink. And she said every now and then the natives from southeast, they would come by and they would bring them blankets and they'd bring them some food.
And you know, Heidi, when we hear details like this and just knowing, you know, what folks went through, especially being displaced and not knowing how to relate to the land. And in those times, it was all about survival. Something else that you mentioned about just knowing what these people survived and what they endured. I think that takes us to a point of just being really appreciative of our elders and what they went through so that we could be here. And then you start thinking about their resiliency. And as you mentioned, these women that you learned their story and just seeing their outlook on life. You know what? There are many lessons to learn. Heidi, we do appreciate you giving us a ring. And it looks like we got Helena back. And Helena, when you think about the resilience of your ancestors, what do you think?
Oh, the spirit of their resilience goes through to me and to my children, and there's no excuse for us in our lives from what they experienced. I do have a couple messages for today. Is it okay if I say them?
Sure. What kind of messages?
Okay. So, Matrice and I, she explained, we're trying to create more chips tattoo for our people. And my message is today. Today is a special day, you know, September 11th. Today is not only a day for respectfully remembering those whose lives were taken and those that sacrificed their lives. It is also a day for reflecting on one's freedom. People like ourselves, Attuans, are still seeking that feeling that freedom gives us, of assurance and peace within. So all Americans can relate to our desire, not just Alaska Natives or Native Americans, because what we need and what we're asking is a natural human need. And returning to our homeland, tattoo, brings closure to our pain of our past and heals our future. And I really would like people to help the listeners from all walks of life to go to our Facebook page, Restoring Attuans Freedom, to help. I just started it yesterday, so it doesn't have a lot of information. But contacting congressmen.
All right.
Congress.
You know what? As you say some of this, building your community to create awareness about all of this is something that we have heard from many people who are understanding how important connections to the land are and what it means to even have this reconnect. And as we started learning about the descendants and their stories of the need to reconnect, it's leading to some special things in coming to a point where folks are even wanting to return to the island. Also here with us today is Zoe Sobel. She's a reporter from KUCB, and she has been covering this story. And Zoe, when you were covering this and starting to learn that some of these descendants wanted to return and were looking at means in different ways, why did you, as a reporter, feel that, you know what, this story needs to be told?
That's a great question. I think the request was actually made at the 75th anniversary of the commemoration of Attu, which was in May, around the anniversary of the Battle of Attu, and it brought together Attuans, it brought together some of the still surviving soldiers who fought on Attu for the U.S., and then descendants of the Japanese soldiers who fought on Attu during World War II. And it kind of came out of the blue when Helena made her first request to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Teresa told me that she was going over with Helena to make the request, and I followed with my recorder because it seemed like it was a big deal. Getting to go back with just 11 people took a really long time, and there are not a huge number of descendants, but a lot more than 11, and asking and wanting to go back seemed like a natural progression of where things were going next, and it's just another way to share and talk about why this history is important.
Sure. And you know what? We're going to go now to Atka, Alaska, to say hello to another voice. We have Crystal Dushkin on the line. She is the mayor of Atka and the director of cultural affairs for the native village of Atka. Crystal is a descendant of Attu residents, and she is Ununga. It is our pleasure to welcome her to the hour. Crystal, thank you for being with us.
My mother's grandmother, my great-grandmother, was originally from Attu, and she married my great-grandfather, Andrew Snigaroff. My great-grandmother was Mary Prokopioff of Attu, and they raised their family here in Atka and were among the Atkins who were taken to Southeast Alaska during the World War II evacuation. And her relatives and family, her sister was Anicia Horikoff, who was married to Mike Horikoff, the last chief of Attu. And so that's my family's connection to Attu.
And Crystal, did you ever get to hear stories from your grandmother or even I also understand there's connections with your husband in the survivors of Attu. Did you ever hear any first person stories about this time? And go ahead.
Yes. So my husband, as you mentioned, he's William Dushkin, and his mother is Elizabeth Golodoff Kudrin. She was born on Attu, and she was taken with the Attuans as a prisoner of war to Japan as a very young girl. She was just a toddler at the time. And so my husband is her youngest son, and she and her brother, Greg Golodoff, are the two last surviving Attuans who, you know, who endured all of that, and are, her brother still lives here in Atka, and Liz, my mother-in-law, she lives in Anchorage, and I did hear stories growing up, and both about the Attuans who were taken to Japan, as well as from my grandmother and other Atkan people who were taken to Southeast Alaska. It was a very traumatic time for all of our people, and the you know, our villages, there were 9 villages that were evacuated here in the Aleutians and taken over to Southeast and really abandoned over there, and that was all done not by the Japanese but by the United States, and a lot of our people died in those internment camps in Southeast Alaska as well.
And Crystal, you know, being somebody who is there in Atka and you know, being a mayor, you know how important it is for the people of a community to know the story of the people. Coming up after the break, I want to hear more thoughts about making sure that the part of the story where there are descendants who are still here and the people who survived all of this, well, they were resilient. I want to know how important it is for people to know these kind of stories. Crystal, we appreciate you being here with us, Mayor of Atka. We're going to continue to visit with her and other descendants coming up here. But if there's anything you'd like to share, you can give us a ring. 1-800-996-2848 is the number. We look forward to your thoughts, your questions, and maybe, again, if this is relating to something that people in your community went through, what are you doing to make sure that this story is told to younger generations, especially that part about resiliency? 1-800-996-2848 is the number. We look forward to your phone calls.
Support by AARP. AARP creates and connects people to unique tools and programs, helps conserve personal resources, and tackles issues that matter most to individuals, families, and communities. More at AARP.org.
Support by the Sisseton, Wahpeton, Oyate Tribes, Dakota Western Corporation, and SWO Plastics. Commercial strength trash bags from 3 to 65 gallons for industrial use by casinos, the IHS, and more. DakotaWesternCorp.com.
Yeah.
You're listening to Native America Calling. I'm Tara Gatewood from Isleta Pueblo. And today on our program, we are talking about Attu Island, its history, and efforts to arrange regular trips to the remote island for its original residents. Japanese forces invaded the island during World War II and took its residents prisoners. And they never returned. If you have any questions or if you have something you'd like to add to today's discussion, give us a call at 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. And with us today is the mayor of Atka, Crystal Dushkin, and she is also the director of cultural affairs for the native village of Atka. She is a descendant of Attu residents, and she is Ununga. It is our pleasure to welcome her back. Also here with us today is Helena Schmidt, and she is also a descendant. She joins us today from Anchorage. And in Vancouver, Washington, is Teresa Deal, and she is a descendant of Attu, and she is also Ununga. It is our pleasure to have all of these ladies on the line. And Crystal, any thoughts just about making sure we never forget this story and even moving it forward about the story of returning to the island? Anything there, Crystal?
Yes, we want to make sure that no one ever is allowed to forget, you know, what happened to our people. But a lot of people in this country don't even know that history. And, you know, it's, we know it's pretty common for indigenous histories to not be told. And so we need to be as vocal as we can to make sure that, you know, everyone hears about this history. The return trip to Attu, I think, is a wonderful experience that we all had, and it's also a great way to, you know, raise that awareness and to help us to educate others about what had happened. And I know all of us who went on that trip to Attu felt very fortunate to have that opportunity. And it was just amazing to be able to step foot on that island. It was something that most of us, if not all of us, never thought would happen in our lifetime. And so it was very special. And, you know, this is, while we were on that trip, my husband and I both were able to go. And we were part of that trip, the group of 11. And, you know, as we were on the trip, we were speaking about with each other about how, you know, this is such an amazing opportunity. It's a once-in-a-lifetime, you know, opportunity, and we're getting to do this. And as we talked about it, even then during the trip, I was saying, you know, why should this just be once-in-a-lifetime? Like, why shouldn't our children have the opportunity to come out to Attu and also, you know, experience that and have that connection to their ancestors who come from this place as well? So, you know, I'm really hopeful that it doesn't have to be just once in a lifetime, that it can happen again.
Sure. And I know people are working on this so that it is more regular. Teresa, I didn't get a chance to hear what it meant for you to step on that soil again. Teresa, go ahead.
Sure. It was just a magical experience, just seeing the islands and then getting out to Attu. It was just magical. It's indescribable. And I agree with Crystal. It should not be just a once in a lifetime thing. I would like to have my children and their children, all of the descendants, to be able to go.
All right. Thank you for that. Also here with us is Helena Schmitz. Helena, I know that you are also working on efforts to see this as a more frequent thing. Tell us a little bit about why, you know, as both ladies just stated, Crystal and Teresa, we want this for descendants. Tell me more. Go ahead, Helena.
Well, one of the reasons why we're doing this is it's not just about, you know, going to the homeland, which it is, but it's about reuniting with our own human identity. I struggled, not understanding where I came from, and, you know, we lost our language, we lost our religious beliefs. So being able to go to somewhere where our family came from kind of fills that gap. And so I hope to educate my children as well. That's what you're talking about, is to make sure people don't forget about this story, that they understand that this has happened in the past, and hopefully they will be able to also see it too. So.
And Helena, what kind of things are being put in place? I know that discussions are happening, but what are the hopes of discussions and movements to bring people to go there on a more regular basis?
Okay, so the Attu Island is owned by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife currently. The village site is owned by the Aleut Corporation, and it is under the Alaska Maritime Refuge, which is part of the Fish and Wildlife. And so that is why I contacted the U.S. Fish and Wildlife, and they have been very open and willing to help, and we are going to continue our discussion soon in this fall. One of the members, Scott Aiken, was a Native American collaborator for their department. He's found some possible funds through philanthropy. I'm sorry. That's terrible, embarrassing. I can't say that word on the radio.
Don't worry about it. There's plenty of words I can't say. Go ahead. Philanthropy. Go ahead.
So they're helping already. So there's a possible funding, but the U.S. government. Okay, never mind. So that's about how far I can go with that.
And Helena, I know, especially with our younger generations, they really understand about their histories and how it affected them. What are your thoughts about this going into your own story of Indigenous people wanting to reconnect with the land or even just go to those places where they were removed from? Why is it important to push forward on things like this?
Like I mentioned, it really brings closure for our pain that we experience, and it really helps us heal internally and spiritually. So I hope to bring and help those families, my family, to help bring that feeling of, you know, that freedom, that healing for returning. Like Teresa said, it's magical. Like there's no real words to describe. And of course, it might be similar to other stories, you know, all the Native American lands were taken away from them and them not being able to return. It's very similar in that regard.
I agree. Thanks for that. And Teresa, can you tell us a little bit about what happened after the trip? Did people get closer? Tell me more about that.
Sure. Although Helena started the trip, she didn't actually go out to the island. Her and I got to get to know each other. The small bit that we had done, I got to get to know Crystal better. I've seen her at events before, but didn't really spend time with her. So just having, I think Crystal talked about it, being close on that ship was really good. And then coming back here, back home in the Portland area, just these people that I talked to before and after the trip, they didn't know about it. And it was just a, I guess it's a conversation starter. We're kind of like an anomaly, and they get to know more about the American history.
Sure. And Crystal, for you, anything you want to share about after coming home and knowing where you had visited, what happened then?
Yeah, there were six of us from Atka who were able to go on the trip. So, we came from a few different families who, you know, of descendants of Attu. But also, you know, just something for the rest of the Attu descendants who either didn't grow up out here in the region or in Alaska even. We, you know, feel like Attu people are also a part of our community here in Atka, because this is where the Atuans resettled after they came back from Japan after the war. And so, you know, our people are intertwined, and we here in Atka, you know, we continue to speak our Unam Tanu language. We have the culture. We have our dance group, the Adham Talavasnikangas, which is the Atka dancers. And, you know, so we are happy to be able to help, you know, the rest of the Atu descendants to learn more about their people and their culture and this part of the, you know, history so that they can reconnect with that identity of our Unangak people.
And Crystal, when you think about the possibility of people to go there more frequently, you know, what do you think about that? That if there was support, what it would bring to their lives?
I think it would be really wonderful. I mean, especially when you consider, you know, that the Atun people were not allowed to go back to Atu and to resettle their own island, their own community, after returning from Japan, you know, after everything that they had endured. It was really just the, you know, the final low blow with everything that happened to the Atuans. And so this would be kind of a way to heal that trauma and make it right again, you know, to let the descendants of the Atuan people go back to where, you know, our ancestors came from, and to have that connection and to see the beauty of that island and the village site where it was is just phenomenal. And to pick that grass is precious to us, and the island itself is precious to us. So it's definitely something that we want to see happen. And and like I said, you know, Atka, we're intertwined. Our two communities, Atka and Atu, are intertwined. We have a culture camp that happens in the summertime here in Atka, the Nihum Temeska, and that's, you know, another resource that we have that we'd like to offer and extend to the descendants of Atu to, you know, try to come to Atka to our culture camp as well, to, you know, bring their children and grandchildren so that our people can know who they are.
All right. Thank you for that. And great to hear that how your community is making space for all of this. And Helena, I think if nothing else, we're hearing that it's important to know our stories, to know what our ancestors have survived and thrived through. Any word to other people out there, maybe even our younger listeners, about how important it is to know where we came from? Helena?
Well, there's a lot of disconnect, you know, with younger generation. It's harder each generation. Like, I have trouble trying to explain to my son. He's 8 years old, and it's really because there is that disconnect with culture. We want to help bring that gap of culture back to them. For example, when I was trying to explain, you know, we can't really go back to Atu to him. He's an eight-year-old, and he's like, well, why can't we go back to Atu? And I couldn't answer his question. It's beyond, you know, his age. So it is that simple. It's like, why can't we go back to Atu? So bringing it to young people is very important to help.
Sure. And Teresa, we are getting close to the end of the hour. Anything you want to share before we wrap up?
No, Vitey was talking about Alice Petrovelli. She was the CEO of the corporation, the Aleut Corporation that I belong to. She was very instrumental in my identity because she was such a friendly person. And so although she was on a different island, she helped identify my mom that's in a book that was written by Nick Golodoff. She was prisoner number, I think, 36 or 37. So she was why I ended up down here. She was an orphan. Her and her sister, my aunt, were orphans, and they were taken to Seattle to a Russian Orthodox orphanage. And I have another cousin up in Port Angeles, and she was also, her mom was also an orphan.
And any words to maybe some of the descendants you haven't met yet, Teresa?
A word to the descendants I haven't met, just stay strong. And that
intergenerational trauma that both Vitae and Helena talked about, it is true. My brother committed suicide. It's just that trauma that is not necessarily passed down, but it is part of all of the descendants. So just stay strong.
All right. Thank you for that. I think those are very strong words, especially thinking about what we face in our daily lives, too. And I do want to share a number in case there's somebody you want to talk to carrying some heavy feelings. There is the Strong Hearts Native Helpline, 1-844-762-8483. And as we close out this hour, I know there are many stories connected to all of this. If there are chapters to this that you'd like to share, you can always reach out to us, send us an email, comments@nativeamericacalling.com. I really appreciate our guests sharing their thoughts today, including Teresa Deal, Christo Dushkin, as well as Helena Schmitz. And also thanks to our reporter from KUCB, Zoe Sobel. That's going to wrap it up for today's program. If you would like to hear this again, you can find it in our archives at nativeamericacalling.com. You can also find it on iTunes, SoundCloud, and Stitcher. Tomorrow, when you meet us here, you'll hear directly from Native artists who are creating coloring books for the masses. Today's show was produced by Soul Traverso. Our executive producer is Art Hughes. Senior producer is Monica Brain. Associate producer is Andy Murphy. Marino Spencer is our engineer. Antonia Gonzalez is the anchor and producer of National Native News. I'm your host and producer, Tara Gatewood. Thank you for tuning in today. And if there are more stories like this, chapters in history that have yet to be written about what your tribe, your family has faced, you want to tell us a little bit about it? We'd love to hear from you. You can always reach us again at email, comments@nativeamericacalling.com. You can also find us on Facebook and Instagram. That's going to do it for today. We'll meet you here tomorrow to talk about coloring books.
Support by Ramona Farms, offering wholesome and delicious foods from our heirloom crops as our contribution to a better diet for the benefit of all people. We are honored to share our centuries-old farming and culinary traditions online at ramonafarms.com.
Support by the American Indian Higher Education Consortium, 36 culturally based open-door colleges created by and for American Indians, low-cost tuition for certificate programs to master degree programs. Info at aihec.org.
Support for this program provided by the University of Tulsa College of Law, offering a 100% online master's degree program in Indian law. This degree can move your career forward and help you work effectively in Indian country. Deadline for spring application is December 1st. Info at law.utulsa.edu/MJIL.
Native America Calling is produced in the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico, by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation, a Native nonprofit media organization. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service. Music is by Brent Michael Davids. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.